Today Break Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. UNICEF says climate change is creating a dire situation for 45 million African children.
Almost half of the 21 countries are at the very highest risk of climate change impacts for children in this region.
The U.S. discusses humanitarian assistance to Chad and Ethiopia. South Sudan's opposition parties criticize new election laws. South Africa's ruling ANC loses an attempt to have a court remove a newly formed political party from the May 29 election ballot. Sierra Leone and Guinean security forces arrest an APC opposition member in Guinea for involvement in last November's alleged coup.
We're not averse to our family member facing justice in Sierra Leone. What we are contending here is we want a due process be accorded to him and any other person as well.
And a major bridge in the busy port city of Baltimore, Maryland, collapses after a container ship crashes into it. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations Children's Fund says there is a dire situation in several eastern and southern African countries where at least 45 million children are dealing with severe food insecurity made worse by climate change. Columbus Mavunga reports from Zimbabwe's capital, where the government says it will not rush to declare a national disaster, although drought is ravaging all districts.
In a statement, Eva Kadili, the UNICEF director for Eastern and Southern Africa, said a prolonged heatwave and drought gripping several countries have left millions of people in a dire situation. She said 45 million children are living through multiple and often overlapping crises intensified by the 2023-2024 El Nino weather phenomenon, one of the strongest on record. Christian Rudet, a nutrition advisor for UNICEF in Eastern and Southern Africa, told VOA that many countries in her region have high rates of child stunting or acute malnutrition. She said the rates are getting worse because of extreme weather patterns associated with climate change.
For example, in Malawi, affected by the current El Nino phenomena, data from the routine nutrition program showed a worsening of the nutrition status of children and increased admissions for acute malnutrition. Almost half of the 21 countries are at the very highest risk of climate change impacts for children in this region. Even small gains in nutrition are now being reversed before our eyes.
UNICEF says it is attempting to help children and their families learn ways of coping with climate change through the schools. Wongani Grace Taulo is the UNICEF Regional Education Advisor for Eastern and Southern Africa.
UNICEF is working with partners, specifically government, UN agencies, civil society, and communities to integrate climate education into the education system, particularly on infrastructure, the use of renewable energy, and waste management.
While that may help Southern Africa in the long term, Zimbabweans are concerned about their situation here and now. One of them is Elita Ncube, with her three children struggling to go to school because of irregular meals. She says, "We have the problem of food insecurity. We are living in poverty. We had donors that used to help us with food, but they have left." However, July Moyo, the Minister of Social Welfare, said Tuesday that Zimbabwe's government will not rush to join Malawi and Zambia in declaring the current drought a national disaster. Moyo said there was no scientific reason to warrant a disaster declaration. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
A senior U.S. official says the United States is extending more than $47 million in humanitarian assistance for the emergency response in Sudan and neighboring countries, including Chad and South Sudan. Ruby Chaba reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Speaking during an online news briefing late Tuesday, the U.S. Assistant Secretary for Population, Refugees and Migration, Julieta Foss Noyes, said she recently traveled to Ethiopia and Chad and met with senior government and humanitarian officials, including Chadian Prime Minister Success Masra.
To that end, I was proud to announce in my meeting with Chad's Prime Minister Masra more than $47 million in humanitarian assistance for the emergency response in Sudan and neighboring countries, including Chad and South Sudan. That amount of money brings the total U.S. humanitarian assistance for people in Sudan and neighboring countries to more than $968 million since last fiscal year.
Noyes also met with Ethiopian government officials.
Since early 2023, Ethiopia has welcomed nearly 50,000 refugees from Sudan. At a time of great instability in the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia's support for displaced populations remains absolutely critical.
In both countries, Noyes said she held meetings to discuss refugee resettlement and humanitarian assistance across the continent, including the protection of humanitarian workers. Noyes said the United States will continue to work with international and local partners to provide life-saving support to the millions of people affected by the devastating conflict in Sudan.
We are committed to working with other members of the international community to help alleviate the suffering of over 1 million refugees forced to flee their homes due to violence. Both Ethiopia and Chad are regional leaders playing essential roles in the Sudan response and broader humanitarian efforts.
The United States is the leading humanitarian donor to the global emergency response to the Sudan crisis. Senior U.S. officials have urged the warring parties to allow unhindered humanitarian access, engage in direct talks, agree to a ceasefire, and end hostilities immediately. According to the Associated Press, the aid package is expected to help alleviate the suffering of nearly 25 million people, including refugees who have fled Sudan into Chad and South Sudan. The conflict between the Sudanese army and the rival paramilitary Rapid Support Forces has left 18 million people, more than a third of the population, facing acute food insecurity. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 27th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Sierra Leone says it conducted a joint operation with Guinean security that led to the arrest of Abubakar Box Conte at the Guinean airport while attempting to flee to Senegal. Information Minister Chana Ba says Conte, a Sierra Leonean, was arrested on March 23rd on suspicion of providing material support in the planning, execution, and escape of the perpetrators of the failed coup on November 26, 2023. Information Minister Barr tells me that former the Conte is also suspected to have to be involved in the trade of drug known as Kush in Sierra Leone.
The Sierra Leone government were involved in a joint operation with the Guinean authorities that led to the successful arrest of Abubakar Box Conte at the airport. He was arrested by Guinean authorities for his alleged role in the November 26 failed coup. We are very clear on what the process is and our promise that we will follow the law and follow the evidence wherever it leads. And the evidence suggests that this gentleman is allegedly involved in the planning, execution, and in the activities following, including aiding and supporting the escaping or hiding of those who were directly involved. Again, I've made very clear that we will follow the law, so that means he's just an accused or he's a suspect at this stage. He will be interrogated by the Sierra Leone police, and we will follow the due process of the law. We will not be involved in any unlawful activities that are being alleged.
So under what legal method was he arrested? Do you have extradition treaty with Guinea?
Absolutely. We have a very close security collaboration and arrangement with our Guinean counterparts, for which we continue to thank them. And this is it's been a common understanding between our two countries. We share intelligence. We do extradite when we have sufficient evidence that we present to each other. And that's the process that we're following. Guinean authorities arrested this gentleman based on the evidence that had been presented to them. And are in the process of bringing him here so that he can help our Sierra Leone police with investigations. It's a very straightforward case of cross-border collaboration.
According to your statement, Mr. Minister, you are also accusing him of trade in illegal substances, including what you called the deadly kush in Sierra Leone.
Again, this is based on intelligence, based on the work of our security forces and intelligence forces. And what we have been doing from day one is we present the information that we have and we present it dispassionately and truthfully. And that's what we have done. That part of the evidence in front of us at this stage is that gentleman is suspected of being involved in the illegal drug trade. Again, all of these are allegations that will be met by a threshold. He will come and be interrogated. He will have a lawyer. He will have a right, again, to prove his innocence or guilt. And then that's how the law works. And that's how it will work.
Chairman Oba is Sierra Leone's information minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Freetown. A relative of Abubakar Box Conte, a Sierra Leonean arrested last Saturday in Guinea, is calling for him to be accorded due process according to international law. The Sierra Leone government says Conte was arrested in a joint operation with Guinean security in Guinea for his role in the failed coup attempt on November 26, 2023. Ahmed Cisse, a family member of Conte, tells me that Conte's arrest may be part of a witch hunt because he is also a regional coordinator of the main opposition All People's Congress Party.
On Saturday night, I received a call from my aunt, that Box Abubakar's mom, that she's been apprehended at the Guinea International Airport en route to Dakar, Senegal. The reasons for his arrest, we don't know, but we gathered from bystanders that a cross-section of law enforcement officers from Sierra Leone and personnel purporting to be Guinean law enforcement officers, they took him off from the airport to an unknown destination, an unknown location. We're worried. Then we started making calls to the Guinean authority. At that time, some of the authorities deny having knowledge of the arrest. And also, we hired the service of an advocate to request for a warrant, if there is any, because we're not aware of extradition treaty between Sierra Leone. I would not say there. We have bilateral relationship through Mano River Union, ECOWAS. But if there is any, that's why we want to see if the arrest is as a result of extradition warrant. We want to see the specificity of that warrant. And also, we ask the advocates to ask if it's through an Interpol route. We want to see the Interpol red letter so we will know exactly the evidence they have. We have faith in the Guinea judicial system. They have interfered, and they, whatever route they want to use, be it extradition, be it through Interpol, is subject to a due process in Guinea.
So, Mr. Abubakar, was he living in Guinea or was he living in Sierra Leone? In other words, which airport was he arrested?
He was arrested in Guinea airport. He lives in Guinea with his fiancée. He's been there for over 4 years and counting, but he's back and forth Guinea and Sierra Leone. We believe it's not devoid of political witch hunts because he's the regional organizing secretary of our political party and his region borders with Guinea. So traveling back and forth Guinea is just a 2-hour journey. But recently, due to intimidation and harassment, he relocated to Guinea, Conakry, where he abodes with his fiancée. The crime they allege that he had knowledge of, he's been in Freetown and the coup. Listen, we're not averse to our family member facing justice in Sierra Leone. What we are contending here is we want a due process be accorded to him and any other person as well, because we believe that there's been a tripartite agreement between our party and the ruling party. Part of the agreement guarantees that those who have fled Sierra Leone because of intimidation be returned in the interest of magnanimity and political unity.
Agnes Cisse is a family member of Abubakar Box Conte, a Sierra Leone national arrested last Saturday in Guinea. He was speaking with us from London. A new electoral regulation in South Sudan has received harsh criticism from opposition parties that see the move as a way to lock them out of the forthcoming general election that will be a first for the world's youngest nation. Sheila Pony reports from South Sudan.
Key opposition parties in South Sudan have termed a contentious electoral law as a scheme by the government to keep them out of upcoming elections in December. The coalition of opposition parties presented a petition to the country's political party council Monday, demanding revocation of the $50,000 registration fee imposed on parties seeking to field candidates in the upcoming polls. The world's youngest nation is set to have its first democratically elected government in December this year. But parties like the People's Progressive Party, SOA, Coalition of Opposition Parties, and United People's Party now see the newly registration fee as an attempt by the government to stifle democracy and restrict the participation of opposition parties in the polls. Opposition politician Lam Akol is the leader of the National Democratic Movement, NDM, and had challenged President Salva Kiir in the first election held in 2010, when South Sudan was seceding from Sudan.
How many parties will afford $50,000?
In 2010, parties had been required to pay about $150 as a registration fee. Riek Machar, chairperson of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, SPLM-IO, the main opposition party in the transitional government, blames President Kiir's side of the government for failing the people of South Sudan. Machar insists that they will not take part in the election unless all the pending chapters in the peace agreement are fully implemented. Opposition leaders also say they don't have faith in the local judicial process should they feel the need to challenge the outcome of the elections. Gabriel Akok, chairperson of the People's Progressive Party, PPP, claims that, as currently constituted, the judiciary is controlled by the government sympathizers.
Considering the current situation in South Sudan, we are not quite sure that we can appeal or we can petition the electoral results when the elections are not free and fair, simply because the judiciary is being headed by the active member of the SPLM, the current ruling political party in South Sudan.
South Sudan is currently under a transitional government whose term is set to end with the election in December. Sheila Pony, VOA News, Juba, South Sudan.
In South Africa, the ruling African National Congress, ANC, lost in court yesterday in its attempt to remove the newly formed Umkhonto we Sizwe Party, or MK, from the May 29 ballot. Professor Sipho Sipe is a political analyst. He tells me that the ruling means that ANC could lose more votes on May 29.
The ANC had argued that the IEC had irregularly registered the MK. So it was more about the registration of MK. And the court rules that the issues raised by the ANC are neither here nor there, that the IEC has a duty to assist the parties that wants to support the democracy. And if a party wants to register to contest elections, that is in the constitution. And the IEC has a duty to assist, because the argument that was put by the ANC is that the IEC did reject the submission by the MK party because the MK party had failed to comply with certain issues. And it argued that upon that, the MK party had to come up with a new application. And the court suggested or indicated that that is not so, that a supplementary submission to correct the defects in the application was sufficient. And it is the job of the IC to assist, not to become an impediment. And on the basis of that, the ANC has an application to render the registration of the MK party null and void was dismissed.
What does Professor Sipho Sipho is a political analyst here. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg. A major bridge in Baltimore, Maryland, near Washington, D.C., collapsed after a container ship crashed into it early Tuesday morning, causing several vehicles and construction workers to fall into the river below. Rescuers were searching for at least six people in the water. Andy Winkler is Director of Housing and Infrastructure at the Bipartisan Policy Center. He spoke with viewers Kim Lewis about the accident.
This is one of those things where you don't expect it to happen, but something went wrong, and something went wrong with the ship. But in the days and weeks to come, we'll also be in federal investigators. We'll take a really close look at what happened to the bridge structurally to better understand what failed and what needs to be done differently in the future.
This bridge was a major thoroughfare for commuters. So how long will it take to clean up something this catastrophic?
You know, it can take weeks. It can take months. It really just depends on how much of a priority this is at the local level, at the state level, and at the federal level, and if that sense of urgency really translates into action. What we've seen in other situations like this, and there aren't a ton of, you know, ships hitting into bridges in the U.S. that we can look to better understand what might happen here, but other bridges have collapsed in the United States, and usually it's critically important that all levels of government get their act together, and when that happens, cleanup efforts can be expedited. But this is a big project. It's likely to take, you know, over a year at least, if not multiple years, to be able to rebuild a bridge of this size, even if everybody's trying to move quicker than a normal process.
What happens to the cargo? Where does it go?
I suspect that the, like you said, once search and rescue operations are concluded, that the focus will be on cleaning up the channel, you know, making sure that the debris is out, whether it's from the ship or from the bridge, and trying to reopen those shipping lanes so that traffic can get to the port. You know, that could happen before, example, construction restarts on the bridge. You might see ships able to return to the port. But it really depends. It's still pretty soon after this incident, and only time will tell, you know, how quickly it takes to get some of that cleaned up.
And this bridge was inspected back in 2021, and it got a rating of fair. Really, what does fair mean?
So we have kind of different classifications for bridges in the United States, and they're required to undergo inspections. The system's changed a little bit in recent years. You have poor, fair, and good quality. I think that's an indication that not that the bridge was unsafe necessarily, but that it's getting older, right? It was built in the 1970s. It wouldn't necessarily have the safety kind of standards that are now required. But it certainly doesn't mean that this was necessarily the fault of the bridge. You know, at the end of the day, a ship ran straight into a bridge's pier. Most bridges aren't built to withstand that.
Andy Winkler is Director of Housing and Infrastructure at the Bipartisan Policy Center. He spoke with viewers Kim Lewis. And that's it for this Wednesday, March 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Button, Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.